At the Fort Collins train depot, Matt Jensen stood with his arms folded across his chest as he watched the activity on the platform. Pogue Willis, unarmed, meek, and unchallenging, was here also, sitting on a bench under the watchful eyes of one of Sheriff Allen's deputies. As it happened, both Matt and Willis would be taking the same train south from Fort Collins, though when Matt reached Denver, he would transfer to a train heading east, while Willis and the deputy would continue on with the train heading south toward New Mexico territory. The deputy would stay with Willis until they reached the state line. At that point, Willis would be released and the deputy would come back. Although Matt was disappointed by the outcome of the trial, he realized that technically, the jury had come in with the correct verdict. No matter the provocation, Lee didn't have to draw his gun. That meant that in the final analysis, it was his own fault. Matt just wished that he could have arrived a few minutes earlier. He was sure that if he had been there, none of this would have happened.
Mr. Jensen?
Turning, Matt saw the bar girl Willis had been beating.
Yes, Miss Simpson, isn't it?
Here folks was calling me Miss all during the trial, and now you're calling me Miss, too. Don't hardly nobody ever call me Miss no more. Not what with me being a bar girl and all. Most folks call me much worse. You can call me Juanita if you want to.
I'd be pleased to call you Juanita.
You was a friend of Mr. Marcus, wasn't you? I seen that you and him talked some right there at the end, just before he died.
Yes, we were friends.
You was friends, and now he is dead. And it was all my fault, him getting killed, all because of the way he took up for me like he done.
It wasn't your fault, Juanita, not at all. Don't be blaming yourself for it. Person to blame is that little pipsqueak over there. He don't look very scary now, does he?
No, not at all.
Juanita walked over to the bench where Willis was sitting.
Mr. Willis, there's something I owe you.
Yeah? What's that? Why, you bitch! I'm gonna...
Do nothing except sit back down on the bench and shut up.
Glaring, Willis sat still and stared down at the ground between his feet. Juanita turned and walked away from him.
Feel better?
Oh, I feel a lot better. Oh, do you think I was wrong?
No, Juanita, I think you were very right. To be honest, I've been standing here wishing I could do it myself. But it's even better coming from you.
I hope Mr. Marcus is looking down from heaven and saw it.
I'll just bet he is.
Oh, I almost forgot.
Juanita stepped back into the depot, then came back out a moment later, holding a package.
I made this for you while you are on the train.
Juanita handed the package to him.
I know I'm nothing but a bar girl, but I'm also a pretty good cook. And I'm just particular good at baking cookies. This here's my mother's recipe. I made a batch of them for you.
Well, it's very nice of you. I don't know what I did to cause you to want to make cookies for me, but I appreciate it.
Like I said, you was Mr. Marcus's friend. And you treated me real nice during the trial and all. Oh, I reckon that's your train.
Yes.
If you wanted to stay here a couple of days, maybe I could... if you wanted to stay here a couple of days, you could... what I mean is...
I appreciate the invitation, Juanita, but I made a promise to Lee I intend to keep.
Yes, sir. And you are the kind that keeps his promises. Mr. Marcus was lucky to have a friend like you.
The train pulled into the station, then. The station manager walked out to the engine and held a sheaf of papers up to the engineer who took them. The engineer filled his pipe as the engine sat at rest, venting steam from the pressure relief valve. Arriving baggage was taken from the baggage car while departing baggage was loaded. With last-minute goodbyes, the outgoing passengers began loading onto the train. Matt watched as the deputy and Willis climbed onto the first car behind the baggage car. Matt boarded the next car behind the one that the deputy and Willis had taken, then took his seat for the start of what was going to be a very long trip. The coach and four rolled onto the Park Avenue Bridge crossing 42nd Street as it approached the great stone edifice that Cornelius Vanderbilt had constructed for his railroad. Inside the coach, on the back seat facing forward, sat financier J. Peerless Bixby, a rather plump, balding man who wore chin whiskers and mutton chop sideburns. Bixby was dressed in a three-piece suit, as befitting a man of his economic station. He was in his late 50s, but because his wife, Cynthia, was an exceptionally beautiful woman in her mid-20s, she was often taken for his daughter. Riding in the coach with Bixby was Ken Hendel. Hendel, in his early 30s, was a small man who wore wire-rimmed glasses and, at the moment, was wearing a suit and tie.
Are you sure you made all the arrangements so I can transfer the funds as needed?
Jay, dear, you have asked Mr. Hendel that same question at least 3 times since we left the house.
Yes, well, one can never be too careful when dealing with employees. For the most part, they tend to be unreliable.
I have never known Mr. Hendel to be anything but reliable.
You can understand my apprehension, I'm sure. After all, there's a great deal of money involved, and when I am done, I am the largest landowner in the entire territory of Arizona. Why, I'll own a ranch that will be the envy of the West.
For the life of me, I don't understand your obsession with owning a ranch.
I am buying a ranch to make money, my dear. The cost of beef is rising every day.
But you've never even been west of the Hudson River.
That's why I will do well. Can you imagine those western cretins doing business with me? I will be their superior in every respect.
When the coach stopped in front of the station, a footman hurried around to open the door. Once outside the coach, they could see the many omnibuses and cabs standing below them. They were met by 3 porters who picked up the baggage that the footman offloaded from the coach.
Hendel, you go with the porters to make certain our luggage gets checked through.
Very well, Mr. Bixby.
And before you come back, check to make certain the train is on time.
He doesn't have to do that. You can see right there on the blackboard that the train is on time.
It may have changed, and they may not have changed the posting.
Oh, Jay, have you ever seen anything as exciting as this place?
Sometimes, Cynthia, you are such a child.
I don't care. I think this is so exhilarating. Oh, Jay, look at all these people and think about the journey they are about to make. Imagine just how many stories are here to be told.
Ha! I can think of nothing more dreary than to listen to some of the stories of these poor wretches. No doubt they are going to see Grandmother or some such thing in some awful place like Indiana or Arkansas.
Why must you always be so hateful, Jay?
I'm not hateful, my dear. I am merely practical. Ah, good. Hendel's back. It's about time. Well?
The luggage is checked through, sir.
The schedule, man, the schedule. Will the train leave on time?
Oh, yes, sir. In fact, it is already here, and I expect they'll be loading in just a few moments.
The train is already here. Well, why didn't you say so, man?
Jay, he did say so. He just this moment returned. I wonder how long it will take us to get there.
2 days to St. Louis. From there, another 3 days to Denver, then 3 days from Denver to Phoenix.
We shall be but 1 week and 1 day in transit. We do live in a marvelous age. I'm told there was a time in the early days of Western migration when it would take upwards of 3 months to cover the same distance we shall travel in a few days.
The car was dimly lit by no more than 4 low-burning wall-mounted gimbal lanterns. When the train came to a halt, Pogue Willis looked out the window toward the depot. The building, constructed of unpainted wide planks, was totally dark. A white sign with black letters hung from the eave of the roof.
Antonito, Colorado.
The conductor came through the car then, moving quietly so as not to awaken any of the sleeping passengers. He leaned over the seat where Willis and Deputy Kinsley were sitting.
Deputy, this is your last stop in Colorado.
Thank you. The next train back to Denver is at 6 a.m. You got any idea where I can stay until then?
That's only about 3 hours. There's a bench inside the depot. You can wait there.
It's closed, ain't it?
Well, there isn't anybody there now, but the building remains unlocked. They don't keep anything of value there.
All right, thanks. I'll wait there. Come on, Mr. Willis. This is where we get off.
Willis and the deputy stepped down from the train.
Looks like it's starting to rain.
Yeah.
I expect you're going to get wet.
What do you mean I'm going to get wet? You mean we, don't you?
No. Like the conductor said, I'll be waiting in the depot till the next train north.
So what about me?
There is no what about you. I was told to take you to the state line, to see if you got across, and that's what I'm about to do. That marker, state line. And this side's Colorado. And the other side is New Mexico.
Why'd I have to get off the train here? If you're sending me to New Mexico, why didn't you get me a ticket all the way to Santa Fe or some such place?
The judge said to get you out of the state. You didn't have no words as to where you was to be, just where you wasn't to be. You ain't to be in Colorado, and this is the last town inside of Colorado. That there marker gets you out of the state. Now come along.
Look, couldn't I just wait here in the depot with you until morning? Or at least until the rain stops?
The depot is in Colorado.
So?
My job is to get you out of the state.
So then are you just gonna leave me here? What about my gun? Where's my gun?
More than likely, your gun is on the train we just left.
What?
Sheriff Allen sent your gun on ahead by U.S. mail. You can call for it in general delivery at the post office in Santa Fe.
But that ain't right!
Think about it, Willis. Do you really think I would turn you loose out here with a gun?
All the time the two men were talking, they were walking. At one point, Willis tripped and fell against Kinsley, but he recovered quickly.
Still! Watch where you're walking.
After a few more steps, they reached the marker.
Here we are. From this point, you are on your own. Ha! If I was you, I'd be finding me a rock to crawl under or a hole to crawl into. Otherwise, you're partner gonna drown out here. Well, so long, Willis. I'll be seeing you. Oh, no I won't, will I? I mean, seeing as you can't come back into Colorado no more.
Turning, Kinsley started back toward the small depot.
Deputy!
Ain't no sense in you calling after me, Willis. You heard the judge's ruling, same as me. I done just what he said for me to do. Now, like I said, your best bet would be to find you a place to get out of the rain.
Turn around, Deputy Kinsley.
What the hell? Where did you get that?
It's your gun. I got it when I fell against you a while ago.
No, Willis, no!
Stepping over to him, Willis went through his pockets, relieving him of all his money.
$3? All you got is $3? Damn, they don't pay you lawmen nothing, do they?
A further search turned up a railway ticket to Denver and another from Denver back to Fort Collins. Willis took the two tickets, then removed the deputy's star and stuck it into his pocket. Willis pulled Kinsley's body up the berm and laid it down lengthwise between the rails. After that, he walked back to the depot. Once there, he stepped into the building to get out of the rain. It was 2.5 hours before the station master arrived. He lit a lantern, then walked around behind the ticket counter. That was when he saw Pogue Willis sitting on the bench.
I didn't mean to startle you there, friend.
Oh, that's all right. I just didn't expect to see anyone here. Can I help you?
Yeah, I have tickets for Denver and Fort Collins, but I've changed my mind. I'd rather go to Santa Fe. The only thing is, I don't have enough money to buy a ticket on to Santa Fe, so I was wondering if there was any way I could just change these tickets to Santa Fe.
Why, of course you can. There's no problem there. I can change those tickets around for you. Just give them to me, and I'll issue a new ticket down to Santa Fe.
Well, mister, that's real nice of you.
The station master took the tickets from Willis and handed the one from Denver to Fort Collins back.
I won't need this one. Your ticket back to Denver is all I need. This one is still good. Or you can just cash it out when you want.
Yeah, cash it out for me.
Oh, very well, sir. The Denver and Rio Grande will be happy to accommodate you.
The station master gave Willis his new ticket plus $2 in cash.
Well, we got that business taken care of just in time. That will be your train.
Matt had read somewhere that St. Louis was a booming metropolis of over 300,000 people, and he could believe it by what he was seeing just outside the window. The city sprawl seemed to go on forever. It wasn't just the spread of houses and business establishments. It was the traffic on the streets. At every crossing, Matt could see wagons, coaches, surreys, and carriages drawn up in a long line waiting for the train to pass.
This your first time in St. Louis, young man?
Matt, who had been looking through the window, turned to see the conductor standing in the aisle.
Yes.
I thought it might be, because of the way you were looking through the window. Beer and shoes and coffins.
I beg your pardon?
That's what St. Louis is known for. Beer, shoes, and coffins. Oh, traffic on the Mississippi. If you've never seen it, you must go down to the river and see all the boats that are drawn up there. Yes, sir, that is quite a sight to see.
Thank you. Maybe I will.
I hope your visit to a fair city is a pleasant one.
The train continued on for several more minutes. Then the scenery outside the window changed. Instead of streets and buildings, Matt saw a huge network of tracks. There in the marshaling yard, the train stopped and began backing. As it did so, it backed under a high roof. And now his view was blocked because the tracks were very close and there was another train on either side. Finally, the train stopped altogether, and Matt and the others stood up and began filing toward the end of the car and the exit. Stepping down from the train, Matt found himself in a large train shed. The walkways between the tracks were crowded with humanity. Steam drifted across the walkways, then rose with the smoke from the smokestacks to gather under the eaves of the great roof. Matt moved with the crowd toward the main hall, then, after claiming his luggage, stepped out onto Market Street. Outside the depot, he saw several cabs and carriages drawn up in front of the station, the drivers openly soliciting passengers. After asking around for the best hotel, Matt was directed to the Traveler's Rest on Washington Street. He took a cab there and went to the front desk to check in. Matt walked over to the desk and began signing the register.
Well, Mr. Jensen, is it? My, I see you are from Colorado.
Yes.
Welcome, St. Louis. I'll put you on the sixth floor. That way you'll have an excellent view of the city.
Thank you. Tell me, what would be the best way to find someone in this city?
Most of the cabbies know the city pretty well. Just give them the address, they'll take you there.
Yeah, that's just it. I don't know the address.
Oh, my. Well, that does make it a bit more difficult, doesn't it? Do you know the person's name?
Yes.
Well, if he has a telephone, you can call him. As a guest of the hotel, you are authorized to use the public phone in the lobby.
Telephone?
Have you not used a telephone before, sir?
No, I haven't. I've read about them, though.
It's really quite simple. You turn the crank to signal the operator. She will then ask you what number you wish to call, and once you give it to her, she will connect you.
The clerk showed Matt how to look up the number. Matt thanked him, looked through the directory, and found an Andrew Marcus. The number beside his name was 109J. Matt turned the crank, then held the receiver to his ear.
Number, please.
Ha! I'll be damned.
I beg your pardon, sir?
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. It just surprised me to hear how this thing works.
You've never used the telephone before?
No, ma'am.
Well, do you know the number you are calling?
Yes, ma'am. It's 109J.
One moment, please, and I will connect you.
What's that?
It's all right, sir. What you are hearing is the telephone of the party you just called. The party answering the phone will say hello, then you can talk.
Hello? Hello?
Go ahead, sir.
Hello. I'm trying to find a man named Andrew Marcus.
This is Mrs. Andrew Marcus. How can I help you?
Mrs. Marcus, I was a friend of Lee Marcus, Andrew's brother. I've come to...
You have the wrong number.
The number I have is 109J.
This is 109J, but my husband has no brothers. He has two sisters, but no brothers.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize for disturbing you.
That's all right. I hope you find your party.
That was the only Andrew Marcus with a telephone, though there were two other Andrew Marcuses in the city directory. Writing down the addresses, Matt went up to his room to leave his suitcase, then went back down to hail a cab. The first house he went to was on South Grand. Asking the driver to wait for him, he walked up to the house. The door was answered by a man who appeared to be in his late 70s. His name was Andrew Marcus, but he had no brother named Lee. The next address was an apartment on Olive.
You have the right address in that Andrew Marcus used to live here, but he moved away last month.
Do you know where he moved to?
Oh, no, sir. I'm afraid I can't tell you that. Oh, but I can tell you that he works at the Anheuser Beer Brewing Company.
Thanks.
Matt had seen small breweries before, but never had he seen anything as large as the Anheuser Company. It was located in a huge building and bustling with activity. Large wagons moved about, some empty, but many loaded with big barrels of beer. In addition to the wagons, there were also several railroad spurs on which stood freight cars being loaded with beer. When Matt checked in at the front office, he learned that Andrew Marcus was no longer an employee of the brewery.
Do you know where he is now?
I don't know, but I'll bet Kane knows. Kane worked with Marcus. You'll find him inside at the mash kettles. Kane and Marcus were both brewmasters.
Is it all right for me to go find Mr. Kane?
Sure.
Getting up from his desk, he took Matt over to a large window, then pointed down onto the floor where there were several huge copper pots.
You see the tall fella with the mustache there on the third kettle?
Yes.
That is Gregory Kane. Go through that door and down the steps.
Thank you.
The door led to an open platform that was elevated above the level of the many mash kettles that occupied the floor. From there, one could see every mash kettle and every corner of the large room. The floor was filled with a very strong but not unpleasant aroma of barley, hops, and malt. It was also warm, as the mash was being cooked in the giant kettles. Matt walked down the two levels of unpainted stairs, then up between the mash kettles until he found Kane. Kane was on a ladder, looking down into the kettle.
Mr. Kane?
That's me.
I wonder if I could have...
Kane held his hand up to stop Matt. Then, closing the top of the kettle, he climbed back down the ladder. Picking up a towel, he began drying his hands. Then he smiled at Matt.
Yes, sir. What can I do for you?
My name is Matt Jensen, Mr. Kane. I'm looking for Andrew Marcus.
Well, I'm afraid you're a little late. Why are you looking for Andy?
First, I need to know if this is the right Andrew Marcus. Does he have a brother named Lee?
Lee? Yeah, I think that's his name. Andy used to talk about him a lot. He lives out west somewhere, Colorado, Texas, some such place. I know that Andy said he was a fool for buying a gold mine from some scoundrel out there. Or, I don't know, maybe it was a silver mine. I don't rightly remember now. Anyhow, he used to talk about how dumb his brother was for doing such a thing.
And he is the one I'm looking for.
Is it something about his brother?
His brother is dead. Before he died, he asked me to get in touch with his brother to let him know what happened.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Andy set a great store by his brother. Even though he went on about how dumb he thought Lee was to buy that gold mine, I think that secretly he admired and maybe even envied his brother for doing that. In fact, I think that's why he took off for Phoenix.
Phoenix?
Yep. Andy went out there last month. He's planning on starting a brewery out there. I told him his brother probably had a better chance with the gold mine than he would with a brewery, but like I said, I think it was his brother doing what he done that inspired Andy, so to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Kane. You've been very helpful.
I'm glad I could be of help. And when you find him, tell him I asked about him and tell him that I'm sorry about his brother.
I'll do that.
Well, good luck finding Andy.
In New York's Hell's Kitchen, where Pogue Willis grew up, his size had been quite a disadvantage. Strength and the ability to use one's fists were what established the hierarchy of Willis's neighborhood. Bullied by those who were larger than he was, Willis had his earlier years shattered by intimidation and shame. Then one day, in desperation, Pogue Willis grabbed a shotgun and blew a hole in the guts of one of his tormentors. No one else in the neighborhood had ever seen an argument settled by any means other than sheer strength. When they saw the strongest of their number brought down by the weakest, they were visibly frightened and gave Willis a new and unexpected respect. Willis discovered two things about himself that day. He found that he had no compunctions about pulling the trigger, and he learned that he liked the feeling of power he experienced by seeing the others cowering before him. It was a feeling he didn't intend to surrender, ever. However, one didn't just shoot someone in New York without answering to the law. Willis had to flee the city, and when he did, he came west. It was the best thing to ever happen to him. There, he learned a secret. It wasn't really how fast you were with a gun that counted. What counted was a person's willingness to kill. And that willingness, in fact, eagerness to kill, gave Pogue Willis a tremendous advantage. Within less than 2 years after leaving New York, Pogue Willis had established a reputation as being one of the deadliest killers in the West. It was a reputation that he cherished. Willis had been in Santa Fe for 3 days when he saw the report in the newspaper.
Gruesome discovery. On Tuesday, a track walker who was making his normal sojourn along the tracks leading south from Antonito discovered the mutilated body of a man who had been run over by a train. As there was no identification found on the body, it is believed to be that of a transient who attempted to board a passing freight train, only to slip and fall beneath the wheels. Anyone with any information as to who this unknown party might be is asked to contact the city marshal at Antonito, Colorado.
Willis was in the Occidental Saloon when he read the article, and he smiled in satisfaction. So far, the body hadn't even been identified, and they were treating the death as an accident. Willis had waited in Santa Fe only long enough for the body to be discovered. Now, seeing that he was under no suspicion, he decided it was time to move on. The only problem was, he needed money to do that, and he was flat broke. Even as he was thinking about the problem, it was solved for him when he saw the tall, gray-haired man at the bar flash several bills.
Damn, Johnny, what are you doing carrying so much money around?
Hey, don't worry, Pete. I don't intend to carry it with me for long. I'll be putting it in the bank first thing tomorrow. I just sold a string of horses to Wells Fargo, and they give me $200. Well, I reckon I better go on home now. I really will be in the doghouse.
Well, good night, Johnny.
Be seeing you.
Willis got up from the table end and went through the back door of the saloon as if he were stepping out to the outhouse. Once outside, he ran up alongside the saloon to see which way Johnny was going. He was heading west, but he stopped to say a few words to someone on the street. The delay gave Willis the opportunity he was looking for, and he hurried down to the west end of the street, then stepped behind a barn. He didn't have to wait very long. No more than a couple of minutes later, Johnny came riding up the street. Willis waited until Johnny was even with him, then he stepped out behind him. Willis ran up to him and quickly found the money. He quickly mounted Johnny's horse and rode away. Matt was in the Old Strong Tavern on Lafayette Street reading the telegram he had just received from Western Union.
As per your request, your horse will be sent to Sundown Corral in Phoenix. Stop. Spirit will be there when you arrive. Stop. You'll settle accounts when you return. Stop. Red Cliff Stables.
Mr. Jensen, are you Matt Jensen?
Looking up from the telegram, Matt saw a man with long hair and a full gray beard. There was something familiar about the man, but Matt didn't recognize him right away.
Yes, I'm Matt Jensen.
Well, I'm J.C. Jones. You may remember me as Trooper Jones.
Yes, yes, of course I remember you.
Matt motioned toward the man's clothes.
But the last time I saw you, you were wearing an army uniform.
Yes, sir, but no more. When my hitch was up this time, I left. Oh, I might have stayed if Sergeant Emerson was still around. Me and Emerson was pards and had been since we was in the war together. But as I'm sure you remember, Sergeant Emerson got himself killed when that fool Trevithan led us into that ambush.
Yes, I remember too well.
You was smart to leave when you did. Not long after you left, Lieutenant Manning, I reckon you remember him, took a platoon out looking for Del Shea. Manning didn't have enough sense to pour piss out of a boot, and he made camp down in a ravine. Didn't post no lookouts or nothing. Del Shea attacked him and killed more than half of his platoon, including the civilian scout that was with him.
I'm sorry to hear that. I didn't scout very long, but I met several of the soldiers and liked them.
Yes. One of them was killed was Angus Pugh. You remember him?
I remember him very well.
Old Angus, he was a colonel in the Confederate Army. Not a lot of folks knew that.
I know he was a good soldier.
So, Mr. Jensen, what are you doing in St. Louis?
A friend of mine was killed, and I came to St. Louis to give the news to his brother.
Oh, it's gotta be hard to do.
I haven't done it yet. Turns out he's in Phoenix, so I'll have to go out there to find him. I'll be taking a train back tomorrow.
Damn, that means you'll be going right back into Del Shea country.
I guess I will, but I don't expect to run into him this time.
Well, I hope not, for your sake. I'll tell you the truth. Everybody knows about Geronimo. But for my thinking, Del Shea's a lot meaner and smarter than Geronimo.
He's smart, all right. He's the one who set up the ambush that Trevithan led us into.
Only if Trevithan had listened to you, there wouldn't have been no ambush. I have to be going. I'm a deckhand on a riverboat now. We'll be pulling out tonight. It's good seeing you again, Mr. Jensen. Good luck. And don't run into Del Shea.
After taking his leave of Geronimo, Del Shea returned to the reservation, where he was greeted warmly by his wife and children. Del Shea saw two Indians wearing the uniform and accoutrements of the Indian police.
Centurio, You have become a running dog of the white man?
I am a policeman.
Yes, like I said, a running dog of the white man. What do you want?
Agent Baker heard you were back. He has sent us to bring you to him.
Oh, am I your prisoner?
You are to come with us.
And if I choose not to come?
Centorio and the other Indian policemen looked at each other, and it was obvious they were frightened at the prospect of having to force Del Shea to come with them.
Do not be frightened, friend of my youth. I will go with you to see the Indian agent.
Agent Eugene Baker was sitting on a stool under an umbrella on the edge of a long, deep trench. There were dozens of Apache down in the ditch, digging with pickaxe and shovel. The ditch was the brainstorm of Agent Baker, ostensibly to be an irrigation ditch to bring water to the reservation from Salt River.
Agent Baker, we have brought Del Shea to you.
So, Del Shea, you come back to us, have you? Did you find that riding with Geronimo was more difficult than you thought it would be?
I have been hunting.
Oh, yeah, well, I have no doubt that you've been hunting. Hey, tell me about the hunting you've been doing, Del Shea. Was it with Geronimo? Uh-huh. Well, that tells me all I need to know. Hunting for white scalps, more than likely. How many white men did you kill while you were with Geronimo? Huh? I have no doubt but that you had the blood of many white men, women, and children on your hands. Well, you want my opinion, Del Shea? I think you should have stayed with that renegade. Because there's nothing for you here.
My wife and children are here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, your wife and your children. You know, the truth is, Del Shea, your wife and children are better off without you. You just make certain you do nothing that'll put you on my bad side. I'll tell you the truth, Del Shea. If I had it my way, I'd hang you right now. At the very least, I'd put you in prison. But the great white father in Washington has ordered that I treat humanely all the Apache who are willing to surrender to authority. So I have no choice but to accept you back onto the reservation.
After doing all in his power to humiliate Del Shea, Baker dismissed him, once more warning him to do nothing that would incur his wrath. Philbin, Oliver, and Cantrell reached the tiny town of Hachita just after midnight. Cantrell bought a bottle of tequila at the cantina, then picked up a Mexican whore, taking her as much for her bed as for any of the special services she could provide for him. Hachita was a scattering of fly-blown, crumbling adobe buildings laid out around a dusty plaza. It was less than 10 miles from the Mexican border, and what made it attractive to people like Philbin, Cantrell, and Oliver was its reputation as a robber's roost, or outlaw haven. The town had no constable or sheriff, and visitations by law officers from elsewhere in the territory were strongly discouraged. There was a place in the town cemetery prominently marked as Lawman's Plot. There, two deputy sheriffs and one deputy U.S. Marshal, all uninvited visitors to the town, lay buried. Cantrell woke up the next morning with a ravenous hunger and a raging need to urinate. The puto was still asleep beside him, and she didn't wake up when Cantrell crawled over her to get out of bed and get dressed. There was an outhouse 20 feet behind the little adobe crib, but Cantrell disdained its use, stepping out into the alley and going against the wall instead.
Oliver! Oliver, you still in there?
Oliver had gone with the puto in the next crib over.
Yeah, I'm in here.
Well, you gonna sleep all morning or what?
I'm coming out.
Oliver was wearing his boots, hat, and long underwear. He joined Cantrell at the wall.
Philbin, where are you? You see Philbin this morning?
No, not this morning. I just woke up. Seen him last night, though. He went into that crib down there.
Cantrell walked over to the crib and looked inside. The whore Philbin had been with was still asleep, but she was alone in the bed.
He ain't here, so where the hell did he go? Well, beats me. Well, I ain't gonna worry about it right now. I'm going over to have breakfast. You wanna come along?
Yeah, I reckon so.
In the Casa del Sol cantina, Cantrell rolled a tortilla in his fingers and, using it like a spoon, scooped up the last of his breakfast beans. He washed it down with a drink of coffee, then lit a cigar just as Philbin and Meacham came in.
Well, I'll be damned. Look here, Oliver. Look who just showed up.
Meacham, I didn't think we'd ever see you again.
I sent word about the time lock on the safe in that bank back in Bent Canyon. Ain't my fault you didn't get it.
If you'd done a little more looking into it than you'd done, you wouldn't have to send word about nothing.
And if you hadn't left early, you would have got the word. The truth is, you got greedy and was planning on keeping all the money for yourself, wasn't you?
What money? The only thing we got out of that was damn near killed. Morris did get himself killed.
Do you want to sit around here and argue about that? Or do you want to do a job that will make us some money?
What's the job and how much money?
I don't know.
You set us up with a bank robbery that's got no money and damn near got us killed, and now you want to set us up with another job, but you don't know what it is, and you don't know how much money. Meacham, you ain't making a hell of a lot of sense, you know that?
I'm not the one setting up the job, but I know who is. And knowing him, I figure there's going to be a lot of money involved. Otherwise, someone like him wouldn't waste his time with it.
Someone like who? Who are you talking about?
He's talking about Pogue Willis.
Pogue Willis? Is this for real?
Yeah, it's for real. I run into Willis back in Arizona, and he asked me if I knew where I could get a few good men for a job he had in mind.
He didn't tell you what the job was?
No.
And you didn't ask?
You don't ask a man like Pogue Willis. If he says he has a job lined up, I believe him. And like I say, a man like Pogue Willis ain't gonna be a wasting time with a job that don't pay a lot.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Philbin, you're willing to go along with this?
Yeah.
All right. You was in Bent Canyon, same as me and Oliver. I reckon if this is good enough for you, it's good enough for me. Now, where is this job?
It's over in the Arizona Territory, about 5 days' ride.
For the first month after he returned, Del Shea felt isolated from the rest of the people. Many, he knew, blamed the slow delivery of meat and other supplies to the reservation on Goyathle, and by extension, Del Shea as well, since he had ridden with the raiders. And because Del Shea was the only one of Geronimo's band present at the reservation, some took their anger out on him. However, there were as many on the reservation who respected and looked up to Geronimo because he was carrying the fight to the white man. And because Del Shea had ridden with him, they treated him with respect and honor. From his cousin, Chandese, whose name meant broken nose, Del Shea learned to make jewelry from the silver and turquoise that they were able to mine on the reservation. Sagazuni, Del Shea's wife, was particularly skilled in weaving baskets of various shapes and sizes, all incorporating beautiful and intricate designs. It had been 2 months since returning to the reservation, and Del Shea was sitting in front of his hogan when Chandesi came to see him.
I've spoken with Baker. He has given permission for us to go to Picket Post to trade jewelry and baskets.
Are we children that we must have permission?
Del Shea, it is the way of life on the reservation. If we live here, we must follow the rules.
Cousin, are you content to follow the rules of the white man?
I have no choice. I have a family, as do you. Would you rather be with Goyathle than with Sagazuni and your children?
Del Shea looked over at his youngest child, who was sitting on a blanket.
Soon the child will be old enough to go, and I will take my family and leave this place.
Del Shea, you must not speak of such things. If the Indian police hear you, they will report you to Baker, and Baker will put you in jail.
Maybe. Or maybe I will kill the Indian police before I leave. I am making the joke, cousin.
I think one should not joke about such things.
Very well. Tell me about the trading we will do.
The white men like the jewelry and the baskets. Tomorrow, we will go to the white village called Picket Post and trade.
Before the sun rose the next morning, Del Shea and Chandesi, along with their families, left the reservation for the 25-mile trek into Picket Post. When they were within 2 miles of the town, they halted.
Wait here for us, Sagazuni. Chandesi and I will go into town and see if they will trade.
Sagazuni nodded her assent. Del Shea's wife found a place in the shade and spread a blanket for the three children. Because some of the merchants of the town resented the Indians coming in to trade, Del Shea and Chandesi thought it would be best to leave their inventory behind as they went into town to invite customers out to trade. The Indians would trade for tobacco, coffee, blankets, and other goods and trinkets that would make their life on the reservation somewhat easier. Meacham, Philbin, Cantrell, and Oliver had been on the trail for 3 days and were now giving their exhausted horses a much-needed rest.
I gotta take a piss.
Meacham walked a few feet away from the others, then stopped.
Well now, what do we have here?
What?
Be quiet.
What is it, Meacham? What do you see?
Come here and take a look for yourself. Be quiet and don't show yourself.
The other three men came up to stand beside Meacham.
What is it?
Look down there.
Meacham pointed to two Indian women and children.
What? All I see is a couple of squaws.
Yeah, that's because you don't know what you're looking at. Why do you think they're out there?
I have no idea.
Me neither.
What do you think, Bert?
Well, I don't know for sure, but if I had to guess, I'd say it's more than likely they've come to trade.
Well, my cousin's smarter than any of you.
That's right.
You mean them squaws just come out here in the middle of nowhere to trade? That don't make no sense.
They ain't by themselves. Not really. Whenever they come out to trade like that, they never actually go into town. If you was to ask me, I'd say that the men that was with them have probably rode on into town to get it all set up.
Bert is right. You know what that means, don't you?
I don't know. I reckon it means the men is in town.
Yes. It also means there ain't nobody watching over their trade goods, but them two squaws and them youngins.
Now, what's that got to do with us? What do we want with a bunch of Injun jewelry anyway?
You don't never think about it, do you, Cantrell?
We can sell it.
We ain't got nothing to trade for it.
We ain't gonna trade. We're just gonna go down there and get it.
Go get it? Meacham, it ain't very damn likely that they're gonna just give it to us.
Hell, I didn't say we was gonna go down there and ask for it. I said we was gonna take it. The men are gone. How much trouble can a couple of squaws and a few snot-nosed kids be?
Yeah. I reckon I see what you're talking about now. Now, we can sell it, you say?
Yeah, we can sell it. We need to go someplace away from here, like, say, Phoenix or some such place. But we're headed that way anyway. Once we get there, we can sell the jewelry for $50, maybe as much as $100. I'd kind of like to have a little money in my pocket when we talk to Willis, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would.
Come on, boss. It's going to be the easiest money we ever made.
Sagazuni, white men are coming to trade. I do not understand why they would come before our husband's return.
Sagazuni looked toward the four men who were riding in single file down the slope of the hill.
Natan, hide the jewelry. I do not think they are traders.
Natan laid a blanket over the turquoise and silver.
Hello, ladies. Got something to trade?
These baskets.
Baskets? Is that all? I was thinking more along the lines of turquoise and silver.
We have baskets. They are very beautiful. Your wife will like them.
My wife. Did you hear that, boys? Our wives will like the baskets. Don't lie to me now, you red-skinned bitch. Give us all your jewelry or we'll just ride away and leave you alone. Otherwise, we'll have a little fun with you two women, then take the jewelry anyway.
Natan rushed towards one of the men, brandishing a knife.
Natan, no!
Natan slashed out with her knife and brought blood from the leg of one of the riders.
Oh, you crazy bitch!
Sagazuni grabbed Natan's knife.
Son of a bitch! What the hell did you do that for?
What about the damn brats?
We got no choice. Shoot the little bastard.
Son of a bitch, Meacham, did we have to do this?
Didn't look to me like we had all that much choice. Let's find the silver and turquoise and get the hell out of here.
You sure there's any here?
Yeah, I'm sure. Otherwise, they wouldn't have put up such a fight.
Meacham turned back one of the blankets and was rewarded with the sight of a pile of silver and turquoise trinkets. He smiled and looked up at the others.
Well, now, looky here, boys. Looky here what I just found. Damn, this is fine stuff. There's a lot of it. I wouldn't be surprised if we didn't get $200 for it.
$200? Well, that's $50 apiece.
Ah, you're all in for it now, I see. Maybe you think old Meacham is pretty smart after all.
Well, this don't quite make up for sending us to rob a bank that didn't have no money, but it makes up for a little bit of it.
It wasn't that the bank didn't have no money. It had lots of money.
Which we couldn't get to because of the time lock. Now, so far as I'm concerned, that was the same as having no money.
Let's quit the palavering and get out of here before the men come back. I've grown just real partial to my scalp.
Del Shea was feeling good as he returned to the campsite. He and Chandesi had found at least 10 people who agreed to come out and trade with them. He thought of the smile he would get from his squaw when he traded for some bright red silk. Even as he was riding back, Delshay began planning the display for them. He knew that if the silver was highly polished so that it shined brightly in the sun, the white men would be willing to give more than they would if the silver was tarnished. He didn't know why that was so. It was the same silver, whether tarnished or shining, and it was very easy to make the silver shine. Yet the whites would sometimes pay twice as much for a shiny piece as they would for a piece that was tarnished. As the two men continued the ride back toward the camp, however, Delshay began to feel a sense of apprehension. He didn't mention it to Chandesi because he had no reason to be perturbed and he had no wish to cause Chandesi worry. But even before the camp came in sight, he began to feel anxious.
Delshay, there is no smoke. We should see smoke.
Perhaps our dinner has already been cooked.
Yes, I think that is it.
Despite Delshay's reassurance, the restlessness continued. Then, the disquiet grew to a strong fear when he saw the large, circling black birds. Delshay didn't have to speak to Chandesi. He saw the circling turkey vultures as well. Delshay slapped his legs against the side of his horse, urging it into a gallop. They were all dead. Both women and every child. All had been shot, even Delshay's infant child. Silver and turquoise was gone. Only the colorful and intricately woven baskets remained. Matt didn't really want to go to Phoenix, but he had made a promise to Lee to find his brother and give him the money. So, checking out of the hotel, he returned to the depot and bought a ticket. Glancing up once more at the clock, Matt saw that it was slightly after 12, so he went into the dining room to have lunch.
You ignorant swine, the soup is cold!
The complaint came from an irritated diner who was sitting with two others, a woman and another man at the next table.
Very good, sir. I shall take it back to the kitchen and have it warmed.
I don't want it warmed, you ignorant dolt. I will require another bowl. I swear, the farther west one goes in this country, the more savage the people and more incompetent the help.
Jay, please. Can't you just eat your soup without making such a fuss? There are a lot of people in here, and you can see how busy the waiter is. I have tasted the soup. I find it quite warm enough.
Yes, I am quite sure it is warm enough for you, Cynthia. But you must understand that is only because you are willing to accept inferior as adequate and mediocrity as standard. I am not. I demand satisfactory service in all things, and I say that being busy is no excuse for ineptitude. And just because you are content with less than acceptable conditions, there is no reason for me to be. You and Hendel are such mice that you would just let people run all over you.
Cynthia did not reply, and she and Hendel ate their soup without complaint. Jay squirmed in his seat, waiting for the server to return with his soup. Finally, the main course was brought, but there was still no soup.
Oh, this is just unconscionable. Now the main course is here, and I still have not had my soup.
I'm sorry, sir. I forgot. I will bring your soup now.
Well, no, you bungling oaf. There's absolutely no need to bring it now. For heaven's sakes. You have already served the main course, so what good would it do me now? However, I do want it clearly understood that I will expect an adjustment to my bill, and you, my incompetent friend, may disabuse yourself of any expectation of a gratuity.
Ignoring the obnoxious diner's complaints as much as he could, though it was difficult as the man was at the very next table and found much to complain about, Matt ate his own meal. Afterward, Matt left the restaurant and walked around the depot, killing time until his train departed. Matt saw a line of railroad cars sitting on a track at the far end of the car shed, and because he was just killing time until his train left, he walked over to look at them. The cars had been there for some time, as evidenced by the fact that there were cobwebs formed on the wheel trucks.
No! Help! Help me! Someone! Please help!
The call for help came from the other side of the line of cars, and quickly, Matt stepped between the cars, then looked up and down the brick pathway. That was when he saw someone being set upon by two assailants.
Give us all your money!
You two, get away from that man!
Hearing Matt's challenge, one of the two assailants turned away from the victim and started after Matt, holding a club over his head.
Mister, you gonna learn better than to butt into something that ain't none of your business. Fact is, we'd just take your money too.
The would-be assailant made a vicious swing with the club, but Matt ducked easily under the attack. Then, rising up again, Matt caught the man with a hard blow to the chin.
What the hell?
The other assailant came toward Matt holding a knife in his hand, low and turned sideways in the manner of someone who knew how to use a blade.
Friend, this here's an Arkansas toothpick. I aim to use it to gut you like a fish.
Not gonna happen.
Matt stepped gracefully to one side, grabbing the knife wielder's arm as he did so. By now, the first man had regained his feet, but seeing that they were now both disarmed and that his partner had been injured, he gave up any idea of continuing the encounter. The second assailant, now holding his injured arm, glared at Matt for a moment longer.
You injured?
No, I don't think so. No thanks to those ruffians. The name is Bixby, sir. J. Peerless Bixby.
It wasn't until that moment that Matt realized this was the same obnoxious diner who had been sitting next to him in the railroad restaurant.
I'm Matt Jensen.
Well, Mr. Jensen, you have my gratitude for coming to my rescue.
I was just lucky that I happened to be here at the right time. I'm curious. What would bring you to this remote part of the car shed?
You called it, sir. I was curious. I grew weary of waiting for my train to depart, so I set upon an exploration of the depot. I wonder, though, if I could prevail upon you to accompany me back to my wife and employee. I do not want to take a chance on encountering anyone else such as these two hooligans. I would be more than happy to compensate you for your trouble.
No, I wouldn't feel right in accepting money merely for doing what's the right thing to do. I'll be glad to walk back to the depot with you.
I shall be eternally grateful, sir.
Returning to the waiting room, Bixby pointed out his wife.
This is my wife, Cynthia. Have you ever seen anyone any more beautiful?
Jay, please. You are embarrassing me. I do not consider myself beautiful, and I find it uncomfortable for you to carry on so.
Nonsense, my dear. Of course you're beautiful. Why else would I have married someone like you, if not for your beauty? It certainly isn't for your intelligence. And this is my employee, Ken Hendel. I keep him because of his business acumen, and also because he is at heart too frightened to ever challenge me. Tell me, Mr. Jensen, where are you bound?
Phoenix.
Phoenix. Well, what a wonderful piece of luck. We two are bound for Phoenix. That means we shall be able to keep each other company during the journey.